You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. With me is my lovely and talented co-host, psychologist Dr. Melody Fox.
And each week we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
We will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
With each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we have both been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us.
And we will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, today's topic takes us on an extraordinary journey, a trip inside a child's body to see, up close and personal, how healing happens. Now, children get a wide variety of common ailments, and virtually all of the time, they get better. And they do so faster than we as adults do. How do they do that? How does it happen? What is going on inside there anyway?
Well, to answer those questions and more will be our guest today, Dr. Chris Johnson. Now, Dr. Johnson has been practicing pediatrics and pediatric intensive care medicine for over 30 years. And during much of that time, he was the director of the Pediatric Critical Care Service at the Mayo Clinic and as professor of pediatrics at Mayo Medical School. His new book called How Your Child Heals takes us truly inside a look at the most common childhood ailments. So, Dr. Johnson, we want to welcome you to Answers for the Family.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Well, we're excited that you're here because I think it's just an interesting thought of taking us on the journey inside of what happens to, you know, any human being, as opposed to just talking about the ailments and what we see from the outside. You really take us on a journey on the inside.
Yeah, it's kind of a mental experiment, and it's something I've always wanted to do and thought about, I guess, because, as you mentioned, I've been practicing critical care and pediatrics for a long time, and for a good chunk of that time, too, I was a biomedical researcher in molecular biology and cell biology, and you're sitting there looking through the microscope, and you're sitting there looking at a sick child, and you wonder, you know, what's really going on or what it looks like, and I don't know, I guess I was always captivated by that old movie Fantastic Voyage from the 60s where you imagine yourself going in and kind of seeing what's going on, imagining yourself about the size of a body cell and seeing this really complicated process unfold. So I've written some other books in the past, but this was the one that was really fun to do because I wanted to be able to explain things kind of using that metaphor. And I think it's a good one because you can use a lot of words to describe things, but this is kind of like drawing pictures with words, really. Mm-hmm. So that was the idea, and I think it went off pretty well.
Well, it appears to. I think it's very fascinating, and I love some of the topics that you have. And I don't have the book in front of me, so I can't point out the actual chapter titles, but I really enjoyed reading over the chapter titles and then reading about what you were talking about. What are some specific trips that a reader takes on this journey that you take them to?
Well, I'll back up just 1 second and describe exactly what I do for you, which is, I guess I don't make you the size of a bacteria. I make you the size of, maybe 10 times the size of a body cell. And the idea is that you get shrunken down and put into this little, it's kind of a combination submarine and ATV that can crawl around between cells or a hovercraft aircraft, just a sort of something that lets you get inside and observe what's going on around you and lets you go through air and liquid and between cells and so on. Mm-hmm. So you go a lot of places. You start out pretty simple by going down and looking what happens at a very, very simple thing, which is inflammation at the end of a finger when you get a sliver in your finger. Mm-hmm. And the way I do all these little journeys is I first have you kind of get inside the bloodstream and travel out to what the normal cells look like out there. And then I have you come back when there's a derangement there of some sort, an injury or sickness or something. So you kind of see the before and after. Mm-hmm. And then in a fair amount of the trips, I have you come back afterwards to see everything all healed up. So it starts out simple with just a splinter and a finger. And then you go and visit an ear infection, because those are really common in children. Mm-hmm. What's going on inside, what a normal ear looks like when you travel around and look at it. Mm-hmm. And then you travel through the digestive system to go down and look at the appendix and see what happens when that gets inflamed with appendicitis.
You go see an
asthma attack, broken bone, a bunch of other things.
Right, and what's nice about that is if your child happens to be experiencing this, you could actually kind of read from your book and take them through the journey on how their body's healing itself.
Well, that's the idea. The other thing I try to be really careful about is sort of seeing, explaining, and watching. And there's a lot of science going on around you, but you don't need to have really any science background at all to understand this. That's kind of the point. I was trying to make it so that people who have maybe only had a little high school biology and nothing more than that can really understand, because a lot of it is quite understandable when you see it, instead of having somebody kind of use a blackboard to describe complicated words and diagrams. This actually just tells you about it in a very, very simple way.
Okay. So does the healing work the same way everywhere in the body?
Generally, yes, but with a lot of specific exceptions to that. And the example I use to show that, I think, is an ear infection, which is a good example of that. When you learn about the splinter in the finger, you learn that inflammation and healing and how cells repair themselves and so on really is pretty similar everywhere. Nature is pretty clever. Once you got the template on how to do things, tends to do things the same way over and over again. But as any real estate agent will tell you, location really matters.
Mm-hmm.
For example, where I live is a place where a lot of people want to live, so it costs a lot more to buy a house than if you lived out in a desert somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the location of the body matters too. And the ear is a good example of that, because you've got the ear has got a little space of air inside there,
mm-hmm.
With some vibrating bones that have to go on to have hearing work. And it's kind of cut off from the bloodstream because there's this little air pocket in there. So the ability of the ear to heal itself quickly isn't quite as fast as the ability of, like, the splinter in the finger. So location does matter. Although the template's the same, there are important exceptions, and you read about some of those in the different chapters.
Right, and you're talking about the ears, and I just remember growing up as a kid, I had so many ear infections, they finally put tubes in my ear. And I remember one summer, it was so hot, and all I wanted to do was go in the pool, but of course I couldn't because I had tubes in my ear. God forbid I got a splash of water in my ear. That was a miserable summer. But, it's like the ears are very sensitive, and, in the damage that could happen to the ear infections and subsequent deafness, I would think, too.
Well, I mean, the ears are a good example of how, as I say, how location matters. And what happens, actually, I mean, ear infection is a good example to talk about. The way the ear is put together is the inside of it is this air pocket with these little bones that when your eardrum gets hit with a sound wave, it vibrates. It makes those little bones vibrate, and then they connect to another little thing on the inner ear, and it's picked up by your brain. But it has to cross this space of open air,
mm-hmm.
and that space is connected to the back of your nose with this little tube. It's called the auditory tube or your station tube. It's just a little connection of air there to equalize the pressure and to keep the air inside there.
Oh.
And if that tube gets plugged up and doesn't drain very well, then things back up, and you get some fluid in your ear, and bacteria just love that. That's how they can get in there and infect it. And, for example, what an ear tube does, which some kids do need, it's like putting in another eustachian tube. Instead of having it drain down to your nose, now you've got this little button that lets the air in from the outside. As you point out, there is a downside, because if you do that, stuff can get in that you don't want in. But the principle is a pretty simple mechanical one, but it's a good example of why the location matters. And then when you get bigger, the reason older people don't get ear infections compared to toddlers is that particular tube gets longer and gets kind of a kink in it. So it's a little harder to plug off.
It is amazing, though, on how the body works.
Well, that particular technical problem is a fascinating one, of how to change a sound wave into an electrical signal in the center of your brain, which is what how your brain interprets hearing. And it does that by this rather intricate system of connecting bones that vibrate and then vibrate this little membrane on the inside of your ear, and that movement is picked up and translated into electricity, which goes to your brain.
Now, Dr. Johnson, you were talking about infections, and we know that children get a lot of these things, but how does our immune system seem to be able to diagnose what's wrong as well as heal it?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and there's a nice chapter in there where I tried to explain that, because immunity is just a fascinating thing. And the more you think about it, the more amazing it is that it works. And the whole idea of what the immune system is supposed to do is to be able to tell, well, we talk about self and non-self. You want to be able to tell who you are from everyone else on the outside, whether it's a bacterium or something like that. And a baby is born with some of that ability, which he or she inherits from a parent. But most of that has to be learned. And it's learned by the encounters that your body has with infections. And that's why children get a lot of viral infections, for example, because their body is learning all those new things. And each time it encounters a new virus or a new bacterium, it makes antibody to it in a pretty interesting, intricate system, which we can chat about if you'd like to. But the result is that your body acquires this knowledge of what's you and what's not you, what's foreign and what's yourself. And that's a very delicate system. And it can get deranged a few ways, but what's really fascinating is that it works at all. It's dramatic.
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just thinking when you're talking about that, about kids getting all these viruses and bacteria. So I was just wondering, can a parent be doing a disservice if they're disinfecting their child all the time and always using disinfectant wipes and everything's so clean so they're hardly ever exposed to anything?
Well, that's a fascinating question, too. And there's just been some interesting research about that because, you want to ask yourself, is it a good idea to postpone these things? We try and seal our kid in saran wrap and keep them from getting anything. And there is some reasonably new research that says that's probably not a good idea, the longer you postpone some of these encounters with lots of common infections, that you might get into a little more trouble. For most kids, it doesn't matter. There's an interesting kind of experiment that folks did just by collecting information, looking at kids who went to daycare early in life and kids who didn't, who stayed mostly home and then went to primary school after that. And they looked at how sick they were and then kind of how they were doing at, say, age third or fourth grader or so. And what they found, which is not surprising really, is that the kids who went to daycare early on, say 6 months, 8 months, and then on through till preschool and on to school, did have more viral infections earlier in life. They encountered lots of other kids sooner, and that isn't surprising. And the kids who weren't exposed to that, either because they were only child at home or just had a few siblings, didn't have as many initial viral illnesses, but they had a bunch more when they went to primary school. And if you looked at everybody by the time they were third or fourth grader, it kind of all washed out, it was the same and it didn't really matter. But having said all that, I think it is true that there's pretty good research now that if you try and really seal your kid in a bubble and keep them from ever encountering any germ at all, you're not doing him any favors because your immune system really kind of needs to meet this stuff so that it learns how to handle it.
Sure. And when you're talking about immunity, it makes me think about allergies, because I know my brother had several allergies growing up, and we had to deal with it as a family. But what is the role of allergies and immunity and in healing with that? How does the body
deal
with that?
The allergy is really a branch of the immune system. I mean, that's a good way to think about it. If it's a particular kind of immunity, and the way you can think of it is kind of immunity to the environment around you. And I think the best way to think of allergy is someone, you're not necessarily abnormal, that particular branch of your immune system is just a little twitchier than someone else's in its reaction to environmental things. A good way to think of allergies is almost like a spectrum, in the sense that even if somebody says, I have no allergies, I have no problems with it, I'll just pick one. Let's say ragweed. In the upper Midwest, you have lots of ragweed. Someone would say, I never have any trouble with that. If you expose someone's system to enough of a particular allergen, they will start to have some symptoms. Then there are other people who just the faintest little whiff of that will, you know, cause pretty severe symptoms, and most of us are somewhere in between. So it is a spectrum, and it is a branch of the immune system that is there for a reason and helps us deal with some environmental things that are trying to invade our body. But what we call allergy is a situation where your immune system, where that part of your immune system, is just a little bit more hair trigger than it should be. So the medicines we use to treat allergy kind of dampen that down.
Now, I mean, is there any reason why different people are allergic to different things? Is this something that has to do with our environment now, how our environment has changed? Does it have to do with the chemicals that are now being brought in? And is there any value to then maybe going much more natural or much more organic to avoid some of these allergies?
Well, that's a good question, too. I don't think there's a direct answer to that, but indirectly I think there is something to that, because I think it is the case that, well, certainly in the pediatric world, we're seeing more children with symptomatic allergies, certainly with you know, asthma. We can talk about a little bit later. There's a component of asthma that is related to allergy. Not everybody who has asthma has lots of allergies, but a fair number of kids do. And we're seeing a lot more of that, for example, and that clearly has something to do with environmental changes. I think it's not a coincidence that we are seeing more kids with problems with allergies. I don't think it's the case that it's just that we're noticing it more, or that maybe 100 years ago we just put up with it more or whatever. I think that is a true increase. You know, I'm not an expert on the particular environmental toxins, but it is reached the point where sometimes things that are everywhere really can be a problem. A good example is latex. If you now go into, if you just walked into a hospital lately, there's probably a big sign on there that says, don't bring any latex balloons in here. Or sometimes medical clinics will have that, because there are now a fair number of people that are extraordinarily sensitive mm-hmm. to latex, which is from a rubber, and to the point where I've had some patients that if you just unwrap a latex glove in the same room, somehow the little bit of the powder or whatever gets over there, mm-hmm. so that we have to just ban everything. Mm-hmm. And we just never saw that 30 years ago. So I think something is changing, but I'm not a real expert on environmental toxins, but it seems too much of a coincidence to have nothing to do with changes in our environment.
Yeah, you mentioned latex, and I'm telling Alan, like me, that's me. I'm so allergic to latex. It's like,
oh, yeah.
I break out in hives if I'm touching it, and I have to go scrub it if a doctor forgets to put on the latex-free gloves. And yeah, whenever there's surgeries, everything has to be cleared out of there, because there are a lot of sensitivities. And I found as I grow older, I have a little bit more sensitivity to certain things, and I don't think was there as a child.
Yeah, and we are learning a little bit more about common sensitivities. Now, again, I'm not an expert allergist, but I know a thing or two about it. And for example, a good example with a common allergen is peanuts or nuts. You know, we know now that in that particular case, avoiding exposure to peanuts for the first year or so of life tends to make it less likely that you're going to have a severe peanut or some of the nuts related to peanut reaction. So in that particular case, you know, earlier exposure is not good, that you seem to want to wait till the child gets a little bit older, and that's why the recommendation, I can't remember what the American Academy of Pediatrics says now, but I think they use 1 year at not exposing kids to peanut butter and that kind of thing. But a lot of it, I mean, allergies, getting back to immunity, like the rest of immunity, allergies have a very strong genetic component, so it does have a lot to do with your own immunity and what you inherit. And that makes sense because we have many examples throughout the immune system where people exposed to the exact same thing will react to it differently. A particular infection, for example, particular kinds of vaccines will produce a really strong response in some people, but not as good a response in other people. The immune system is really closely linked to heredity, and that's especially true when you start talking about some examples of when the immune system can go wrong, what we call autoimmune disease or disorders where the immune system gets confused about self and non-self and starts to attack your own body rather than what it's supposed to attack. And that clearly has a genetic component. The most common example in children, I think probably in adults too, would be type 1 diabetes, a disorder where your body stops making insulin because your body has made your immune system has become confused and made antibodies against the cells in your body that make insulin and has destroyed them, so you can't make insulin anymore. Mm-hmm. There are many other autoimmune examples, but that's a really common one.
Okay, and Chris, what I was thinking is that one of the things that I like about the way the book is set up is that you really set it up as a journey where you are, you know, you're taking people through, you know, as if they were a, you know, a small component that is being put into the body. Can you, I mean, walk us through one of these journeys a little bit so people can get kind of the idea on how the book flows?
Okay. Well, yeah, I start with simpler ones and get more complicated ones. But we could pick asthma as a good example. It's a common disorder, and it lets you see what the respiratory system is like and gives you a little taste of the other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what I do in that one is I start out by having you just take a trip deep into the lungs in a normal situation, when things are working well, and you do that by getting in your little, this time it's kind of like a hovercraft or a helicopter, really, because most of the lungs that are made of air, so you're going to be flying rather than swimming. And you go in through the nose and head down through the major large airway, which is the trachea, the major windpipe, and then you head on down through the smaller and smaller windpipes. The way to think of the lungs' air conducting system is like a whole tree of pipes, and they get smaller and smaller, and they eventually end in these little air sacs, which is where the air and the oxygen in the air gets right up against the bloodstream and goes into the blood, and then the carbon dioxide that is what your body uses, that's waste, comes out of the blood and into the air sacs and gets breathed out when you exhale. So that's what it looks like in the beginning. And then I have you leave, and then I have you come back during a severe asthma attack. And what you look around you and see, and in the first journey I pointed out using a sort of a searchlight on your craft all the different landmarks of what you're going to see in the lungs and what's supposed to be there and what the walls are supposed to look like and so on. Mm-hmm. And then you come back during an asthma attack and you see that everything's really fouled up in a bad way. You see the air isn't moving very well because the little airways are squeezed down, and you kind of get through there with your little craft and you see exactly what's wrong, that some of these smooth muscle bands that are supposed to be, they're like little hose clamps. They're not supposed to scrunch down as much as they are, and they block airflow. And you also see lots of mucus and inflammation everywhere that shouldn't be there when there's not an asthma attack going on. So then I have you leave, and then I think I have you come back. Oh, I have you in there, and that one, I have you in there while the treatment starts, the breathing treatment, and you see everything relax and get better in the course of the treatment.
Yeah, and you're mentioning treatment. I keep thinking of my baby brother who had severe asthma attacks. They're always doing treatments and running him to the hospital and in his room with the air humidifier and everything else. And that's a really difficult disease or you know, ailment that a child could have. And it is very prevalent.
It is, and it's becoming much more common. It's a scary thing, too, because there are some kids that get sick very fast with it. The little airways, you know, squish down really quickly, sometimes virtually over seconds. There are other kids that get kind of gradually get into more trouble over hours to a day or two, and their parents know that they need to have, you know, see the doctor and have things improved a little bit. But there's a subset of kids who get sick very fast, and that can be very scary for them and for parents because the air doesn't move in and out very well.
Right, exactly. And I want to talk a little bit more about that, but we have to take a quick break. We are talking to Dr. Chris Johnson. He has written a fabulous book, and I don't have the title in front of me. Ellen has it in front of me.
How Your Child Heals.
That's it. Thank you very much. How Your Child Heals. And that's my memory there. It's. We'll be back in just a moment with more Answers for the Family. Stand by.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back. We are talking with Dr. Chris Johnson.
He's the author of How Your Child Heals, and we're talking about his new book.
So anyway, what we were talking about right before we went to break was really, I believe you were walking us through one of the
We were talking about
journeys.
Asthma and the journey there.
Yeah.
And we're also talking, and what I wanted to follow up with you, Dr. Johnson, was because I keep thinking back to all the asthma attacks my baby brother went through, and I was just wondering, are there any psychological conditions that people go through or are affected by when they have that? Because I know he's got like a fear of going to hospitals and things, so I'm just wondering, is there... You know, how does that affect a child to be going through treatments and heavy-duty ailments, et cetera?
Well, we can kind of unpack your question just a little bit because there are a couple of good questions built in there. Just regarding asthma itself, we were talking a little bit earlier about allergies being kind of a spectrum from of ranges of normal, really. Asthma is a similar kind of situation. Asthma is... kind of the way the lung responds to a wide variety of insults, of things it doesn't like. Some of these things are infectious, some of these are like viruses, some of these things are environmental, like breathing in something you're allergic to. But that response of what the lung does, which is a couple of things. One is that all these small airways have these kind of lassos around them of smooth muscle to pinch them down. If you take anybody, a normal person, who doesn't say he has any symptoms of asthma, you can make those things constrict. So in other words, we can manipulate it so that there are things that will make everyone have the equivalent of an asthma attack. And what asthma really is people who have more of a tendency to do that in certain situations, whether it's some particular pollen or exercise is another common thing. And so when we say that more and more kids have asthma, what we're really saying is that tendency is kind of moving further along the spectrum. And I guess I should, right at this point, it's kind of interesting to point out that you might say, well, why are those muscle bands in there? I mean, why would anyone have their hose clamps around their airways to constrict them down and cause an asthma attack? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Why would nature do that? And actually, what's happening in an asthma attack is that a normal system is kind of being fouled up. The reason that your body has those is that your lung has to have ways of moving airflow from one place to another inside the lung. Mm-hmm. Think of it as like an irrigation system, although the blood supply to the lung does the same thing, and that really is a liquid. But let's just think of it that way, where the different head gates and so on in the irrigation system might direct the flow to this field or that field or, you know, different places that you wanted the water to go. Same thing has to happen in your lung. When you change position, like right now I'm sitting up as I talk to you, mm-hmm. if I were to lie down over a second or two as I would take breaths in, the air flowing into my lung would redistribute it to go to different places because it has to match where the blood is. And your body has to have a way of sending less air to the top of the lung, more air to the bottom, and vice versa, and the front and the back and so on. So it uses those constricting loops around all the airways to do that. Huh. The problem with an asthma attack is it all happens at once. So you're constricting all those airways at once, and so that's an abnormal response. What the treatments we use are to relax those airways, but it's just that it's a normal system kind of gone awry. That's really what an asthma attack is. Now, as far as you asked before about a psychological component to asthma,
Or any ailment.
Well, regarding asthma, there are, for some people, clear psychological triggers to breathing problems. Now, it's not the majority of people, but there are some people, children, and some children in particular, who can have a major psychological overlay to their symptoms. And these are kind of kids that benefit definitely from different kinds of behavior modification, everything from hypnosis to feelings of well-being to, I mean, there's different ways that you can do to make them feel better, and that will improve their asthma. Just on that subject overall about healing and the relationship of the kind of the brain and the and psychology to healing, it's pretty clear that there is a major connection there. And it's one of those things that I guess every grandmother knows, and maybe all of us have known for 1,000 years, is that, you know, if you're everyone doesn't heal the same. And why is that? And there have been some good studies, for example, in depression. And now these have been in adults, not children, but if depressed adults, when they're, and these are folks who, you know, have a doctor's diagnosis of depression and typically are taking some medicine for it, they don't heal as well. And if you do standard things to them, like if they're having a standard surgery operation, people have actually found that their incision doesn't heal as quickly. It just kind of all down the line, they don't heal as well. And that people who have a better sense of well-being and a better and are not feeling that sort of mood disorder heal better. Now, it's not a huge component, but it's measurable and it's real. And of course, with kids, it's a little harder to know. You know, you're trying to figure out if a 2-year-old is, you know, where they're at in their brain. But it makes perfect sense to me that a child who is agitated and upset and distraught in various ways is not going to heal as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Dr. Johnson, I mean, as a parent myself, I think that there's a lot of things that we try to do that we think are truly related to healing, some of which may be accurate, some may be kind of wives' tales. But what are some of the things that we as parents might not think are related to healing, but yet they really are?
Well, I think that one, their psychological state makes as much sense as anything to me. And I think it's something that parents think that it's not a big deal. I think, well, of course, we try and make them feel better or whatever. We try and make them feel wanted and loved and kind of surrounded in a cocoon of love. And that really has a major effect. And I can actually point to another, it's a related question, but another kind of study that was actually done in children that's a very good demonstration of why that sort of thing might be so. It was related to children who had had major heart surgery, and it was looking at relieving their pain and anxiety afterwards. And what, believe it or not, I mean, I've been in this for 30 years, and, you know, 30 years ago, people used to, and we, because I was in it, were really not as vigilant in relieving children's pain and anxiety as we are in adults. I think it's because 50 years ago, they actually taught the children don't feel pain and anxiety in the same way, and so we didn't have to worry about it so much. And I think it's also because children can't complain, and so we would do things to them that no adult would put up with without being as vigilant in using painkillers and anxiety medicines. Anyway, when you looked at post-operative heart surgery in children, the kids who had a more aggressive, that is, to really be vigilant about are they uncomfortable, are they in pain, are they upset, and trying to relieve that in various ways, some of them medicine, some of them other kinds of things, distraction therapy and so on, they actually healed significantly faster and got out of the hospital faster. Mm-hmm. And the basis for that is that when you're upset or when you have an injury of some kind, your body has releases quite a few stress hormones from the adrenal gland and a few other places. And these are kind of the old fight or flight kind of hormones. They were designed to give you the ability to run a little faster, jump a little higher, get away from that tiger after you. But they also inhibit healing. And when you're in a situation where you're agitated, upset, there are more of those hormones present and you don't heal as well. And that's something that we kind of take for granted as parents, but I think that, you know, if your child hurts, we try and relieve their pain. If they're upset, we try and comfort them. Another thing parents always ask me about is, you know, certainly grandparents, you know, does it help to, what about nutrition? Does it help? Is there anything we can give them? Can we give them extra food? Can we, you know, get them kind of parked up and get them to heal better, faster that way? And that doesn't really seem to be the case. On the other hand, the downside is certainly true that if you're not getting good nutrition and if you're not getting a, you know, decent diet and so on, you don't heal as well. And there's a lot of good research to show that's the case. But if you give someone who's sick and healing from that illness extra stuff, they're probably not going to use it. Hmm. So I can't remember what your next question was.
Well, we have a few, but Al and I are looking at each other who wants to go next. But you're giving some wonderful, you know, examples of how things really are good. And I really like what you're talking about, the psychological aspects too, and making a major positive effect on the healing of children, of making them feel wanted and loved and secure, and helping ease their pain so they can feel better, so they can heal. But what are some examples of healing not working out so well?
I put some good examples of that in there. And I just want to back up for one second to point out about one thing, I recalled it about the connection between the mind and the body. And that, you know, it's funny that observations that we know and we sort of intuitively feel are right, and sometimes the science lags behind in catching up. Mm-hmm. And it's been recognized that a lot of the signals that cells use to talk to one another in the immune system are also neurotransmitters in the brain, and are related to mood. And so it makes perfect sense that immunologists are now finding kind of in a test tube how you can explain the fact that people who are stressed and depressed and so on don't work as well, and their immune system doesn't work as well. So it's an example of kind of the science lagging far behind, but eventually catching up, what we intuitively knew to be the case. But as regard to your other question, yeah, sometimes healing doesn't go all the way. It doesn't complete things. And there are, I have a couple examples of that. Some of them simple, some of them more complicated. There are times, a good example of when things aren't optimized well. In the case of when you talked about having had ear tubes as a child, you had a lot of ear infections there, and what was happening there is that and in some kids, you know, not every kid with ear infections or recurrent infections need ear tubes, but some of them just aren't draining that ear very well. And they're not going to unless we help out. And that's what the ear tube is designed to do, is to, and they're also called ventilation tubes, to help get some air and ventilation in there. Mm-hmm. So that's a good example of because of the way your skull was shaped and the way your genetics were, you just weren't going to get that taken care of until you had a little help. Other simple examples are if you've got a, let's say you've got a kid with a big sore finger on the end and it just isn't healing and isn't healing, and you look at it real closely with a magnifying glass and you see there's a splinter in there and it's just not going to heal until you get that splinter out. Mm-hmm. Well, you can take that metaphor and make it more complicated with people with their children with more severe illness, problems with blockage of their intestines or, you know, anything like that, where it's just not going to heal unless we go in there and help fix it. So there are times when even though we have this marvelous process that can put everything back together again, sometimes by mechanical reasons, and in those cases I just mentioned, we need to help nature out. There are other examples where the healing process gets kind of just fouled up. I mentioned briefly a little bit about autoimmunity and diabetes. That's a good example of how the immune system, which is normally the sort of thing that makes us get better, can get deranged and can attack us. And there are a whole host of conditions that are like that, where we have to treat them really by dampening down the immune system and trying to blunt it, really, because it's like it's in overdrive and it's confused, and we need to tone it down. Unfortunately, we don't have a way yet of kind of teaching it the right stuff, you know, to stop attacking the body. Really, all we can do is to just kind of dampen things down. Well, but there are certainly are times when the body gets confused.
Well, and you were talking about helping it. I know in your book you talk about how not all foreign bodies impede healing. So I would imagine that would be the times that you're putting stents in, or you're fixing something or putting something else in, that the body actually will respond positively to.
Yeah, exactly. There are, we have to kind of learn by trial and error on how to do that. Interestingly, with back to immunity, I mean, we've learned so much about immunity by studying transplants, because the whole idea of organ transplantation is to figure out a way to have the body's immune system, which, you know, the usual response, if I put a, and this was done years ago, if you put in a foreign piece of tissue into someone else, the body will, within seconds, start to reject it. And transplant medicine really became possible because we figured out ways of kind of confusing the immune system to get it to accept this new liver or this new kidney as part of the same team. And so learning how to do that wouldn't have been possible without learning about immunity. Although, I mean, our tools still are pretty blunt. I mean, we can't really, and there's a lot of research now to try and, you know, make your body really accept that new liver or new whatever as, you know, part of the same team. Don't worry about it. It'll be forever part of you. Really, the ways we have now are still of giving medicines that suppress immunity so that the recipient's immune system will not get too upset with the transplanted organ. But that brings with it problems if you suppress somebody's immunity so that they will take a new transplanted organ. You're also suppressing their immunity, so they're more likely to get serious infections. So it's a two-edged sword with that.
Well, Chris, and we have listener questions that have come in. One that is come in reads, as a therapeutic program counselor in Utah, I can tell you that poor nutrition is being discussed more and more in our industry as being a contributing factor to ADHD and other behavioral conditions. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I'm not an expert in ADHD, but I do take care of some patients with that, and I think that's true. And as I mentioned, that getting someone's it's as if having a bad diet does bad things. It's not entirely clear that having a super, super good diet does good things, if you kind of catch my drift there, where it's just you want to prevent having an inadequate one. I think in the case of ADHD and diet and kids, adolescents generally now, the problem is that we have a bunch of issues balled up with one another. We have sedentary kids not eating well, getting obese, getting asthma, even some of them getting type 2, that is the adult type diabetes, having more behavioral problems. They're increasingly being linked to video games, and you kind of have this very complex ball of things that are all related to one another. Certainly, in the intensive care unit, I'm often asked to, I guess my most common encounter with ADHD kids is I'm asked to give them sedatives so that they can have various kinds of procedures like MRI scans and things of their head, because people are, you know, evaluating their problem. And it seems like, as your listener described, they don't eat well, they sit in one place, they play computer games all day, they are on about 5 ADHD drugs, and you can't really figure out which one is most important or not so important. They may have breathing problems from their asthma, and it's kind of a complicated mess.
Right.
But that phenomenon is becoming more frequent, I think, in practice today.
Yeah, and we have a listener comment actually. As a mother of 3 children, ages 6 to 15, I've spent my share of time at the doctor's office and hospitals with fevers, broken bones, and other minor illnesses. Typically, other friends with kids are more helpful and informative about post-procedures than any of the doctors we have met. And I look forward to reading your book. So how is your book going to help her understand this a little bit more?
Well, I think it's going to help her explain what's happening. The other thing to encourage her to, she could go to my website and see my other book. One of my other books is about how to talk to a doctor, which is, so I'm on chrisjohnsonmd.com, and there's my second book, because that's precisely the problem on that, is the doctors are not very good at explaining anything, unfortunately. And it's almost as if you need a decoder ring to understand what they're saying. And now your appointment time is getting shorter and shorter. It's like you have to be prepared with a list, because you get your 5 minutes and then they're gone. And now what? Because I thought of my real question, they were out the door. And it is a problem. And I think that the one book we're talking about now, How Your Child Heals, will help you explain what's happening in the body. But if you really want to know how to talk to a doctor, you might want to pick up my second one, because it's like imagine yourself like visiting a foreign tribe and taking along your decoder ring there to understand what they're saying and how to make best use out of your time and the doctor's time.
Right, sure.
Absolutely. And Chris, we have about 1 minute, but again, for anybody that's out there, that's www.chrisjohnsonmd.com for more information on this book and or one of his prior books. Now, a last question. It says, I see at the end of your book, you have a chapter called Healing and the Tree of Life. Tell us a little bit about that. And again,
real brief.
We've got about 1 minute.
Yeah. Well, we are what we come from, and it's a book about tells you about stem cells and how we evolved from our own stem cells and how we're related to previous creatures who are made of stem cells. And it points out how the highly technical, specialized nature of all these systems we've been describing are really connected to things that are in other creatures, and that by looking at other very simple creatures, you really can understand healing. And a lot of research about healing now is actually looking at some very primitive creatures to see how they do it, because they, in many respects, do it better than we do.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And we're talking to Dr. Chris Johnson today, the author of the book, How Your Child Heals. It's a wonderful journey explaining the different parts of your body and for you and your kids. So on behalf of Al and I, we'd like to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Answers for the Family. And please join us next week as we continue.
Raising children is a tough job. The job is even harder due to all the distractions, temptations, and dangers facing teens and their parents in our modern age. Some of these children are especially challenging and make such poor decisions as teens that their parents fear for their child's safety and future. I'm Lon Woodbury, and as an independent educational consultant, in my 22 years of practice as Woodbury Reports, we have worked to help hundreds of parents individually throughout the country who fear for their child's future. We also have an extensive website, strugglingteens.com, that provides as much objective information as we can to help parents. And we produce an LA talk radio show interviewing leading professionals who are helping parents right after Answers for the Family. If you have a child whose decisions make their future in doubt and you are looking for help, you can call me at 208-267-5550 and I'll be glad to try to help you. Or check my website, strugglingteens, that's one word, .com.